improbability. After she's been around for a few days, I ask what she's been eating during her forays into the spiritual side of the city. She answers, not surprisingly, not much. She grabs a coffee and a pastry when she can, maybe a salad now and then. The idea of someone visiting New York and not experiencing a proper deli is unbearable. So I ask her to pencil me in for lunch today, and off we go. As we entered the narrow deli, we got squeezed in behind a woman of about 60, short, stout, and severe. Just inside the door, she dropped her leather binder on the floor. I couldn't get around her to be a gentleman and pick it up for her, so we had nowhere to go until she retrieved it and moved on. What spilled out of her binder was unmistakably a copy of Damnedest, with the black and white cover of the pre-publication review copies, all marked up, bulging with post-it notes, and held closed with rubber bands. Jolene saw it as clearly as I did. We entered the deli. The woman took a number and waited to be served. I motioned to Jolene, and we turned around and left. As we walked, I knew Jolene was watching me with a big, drop-jawed grin on her face. But I wasn't ready to deal with her amazement yet. I was still dealing with my own. This was way beyond too much. What are the odds? Too astronomical to compute. There are only like 50 of these pre-pub copies in existence. What are the chances that I'll be in New York, entering some deli behind some woman in such a way that I can't get by, just as she drops her binder and spills out a copy of a book I'd just finished writing, face up, so I could see what it was? No chance. The whole thing was so far outside the realm of possibility that my first impulse was to look around for the hidden cameras of some TV stunt. I am pretty well attuned to the subtle nuances of the universe. It's through this carefully developed sense that I relate to the world with an unerring ease and confidence. This thing with the copy proof, however, had nothing to do with nuance. This was a deafening gong. Nothing subtle about it. But indicating what? For what purpose? I had absolutely no idea. It was just this huge, astounding non-thing. This event was so fantastically unlikely that I might have doubted my own memory afterward had not Jolene seen it as clearly as I. Perhaps that woman will someday read this and remember dropping the book as she entered a deli, and find out now that the author of the book was standing inches behind her. What will she make of that? My mind scurried to get a handle on this, but couldn't. What's the point of such a bizarre occurrence? What am I to make of it? Has the universe simply abandoned all restraint? It's so utterly, preposterously, incalculably unlikely that the only conclusion you can come to is that, once you get to know it a little bit, the universe is really just a big, playful puppy. I might interpret it to mean that the universe is telling me we're headed into a whole new way of functioning wherein nothing is too much, nothing too absurd or too fantastic. Maybe the dream metaphor is no metaphor at all. Or maybe the universe is telling me that the book was out there now, that it's a living thing with its own course to follow, its own destiny. Too much? Not enough. None of these explanations feel right, but I can't tell. Maybe the dream is unraveling right before my eyes. That would be redundant, and I'd mildly rather it didn't. But who knows? Maybe the universe, for its own reasons, wanted me to write about this experience, to play with these conclusions in print. Maybe it happened so I could say it happened, so someone could learn something by reading about it, get their next door opened. Maybe it was somehow for Jolene. I really have no idea. Fortunately, I don't feel the need to understand everything. Most things make themselves clear in time, but there's nothing in me that suggests that if something doesn't make sense to me, it must not make sense. Everything makes sense. In the few years since this incident, I've had a dozen other probability-defying experiences, and the explanation I've settled on is the big, playful puppy theory. My Uncle the Vampire. I'm laying on an armless leather couch trying to establish a deeper rapport with Mozart's Requiem, which is being played on DVD by full symphony orchestra, on the TV, and filling the room from the surround sound speaker system. I have a ticket for a performance of Requiem in a few weeks, and I don't like to go to these things cold. I have the DVD, a CD, and some books to help me out so that when I attend the actual performance, I'll have at least a basic familiarity with what's being expressed, by who, and why. And this will allow me to relax and appreciate the experience rather than waste it by staying in my head the whole time. I'm a little familiar with the Requiem, but I'm not a real classical music buff. So it's this added dimension that makes the whole thing so enjoyable. Mozart died before finishing the Requiem, and there are several versions of the completed work. The DVD I have is the Levin version, and I have a CD of the Maunder version. But the performance will be the Sussmayr version, so it's an interesting adventure in appreciation, or so I'd hoped. As it turned out, I only muddied the whole thing for myself. I should have gone deep into one instead of shallow into three. Nevertheless, it was an interesting endeavor, and still is. I kept at it, and now I have a much better understanding of the piece and the attempts to finish it. And I now have a preference for the Levin version from a more informed perspective. I bore you with all this to explain what I mean when I say I went to NYC to wallow in the arts for a while. I don't race through museums, see every play and concert, and snarf down expensive meals. On this particular trip, I put my attention on the Requiem. Two plays, a dozen or so restaurants, the Cloisters in northern Manhattan, the Botanical Gardens in the Bronx. There was some other miscellaneous stuff, and I also went to Chicago for a week at one point, but the way I go about this sort of thing is to get a bit immersed instead of just skipping across the surface. Interesting? Probably not, but that's what I'm doing. Head flipped back on the end of the couch, mouth agape, somber music filling the room, when in walks Jolene plus one. Although viewing the situation upside down, I can see that she has brought home a stray. I hit the pause button, close my mouth, and roll awkwardly over, backward and upward, until I'm approximately upright. Jolene introduces me to Zach. He's tall, thin, early 20s, and exceedingly groomed. He's one of those closely trimmed mustache and partial beard deals that combine with his two small hoop earrings to give him a piratish air. I'm pained to think that just shaving and trimming hair must take him an hour each morning, which is about what I spend on it per annum. I shake his hand, trying not to come off like Jolene's parent or guardian, and tell them to make themselves at home. Jolene grabs some bottles of iced tea out of the fridge and passes them around before plopping down on the futon I just sprang up from. So I turn off the TV and DVD player and start to consider what I want to do next. Zach stands nearby, holding his bottle, and I'm just standing there holding mine. And I start to get the idea that we're all here together rather than them being together and me going away. Being socially inept, my usual response to situations like this is to do what I like and let people be offended if they want. In this case, that means I leave, which I start to do when Jolene speaks up. Zach and I met at the coffee shop, she informs me. I knew she had heard about some nearby coffee place with an mystical motif and a spiritually oriented crowd, and that was where she had gone off to this afternoon. I didn't know they offered takeouts, like young Zach, but it really couldn't be less of my business. Seeing that I have no response but an insipid smile, she continues. Zach is going to be a really great spiritual teacher someday, she goes on. He was in the coffee shop talking, and there were like 10 people standing around his table listening to him. She smiles at me, and there's a twinkle of playfulness in her look. So now I'm a little more interested. What has she dragged back to our lair, and why? I told him about you, she says, and I feel my head tilt slightly. I know she didn't tell him about me, but I guess she told him something. I told him you had very strong spiritual beliefs, but they were not really in the mainstream, and that you were writing a book. And he said he'd like to meet you someday, and I said, how about now? I'm intrigued, because I know that she hasn't done what it looks like she's done, and I'm wondering what she's really doing. I'm also amused by the fact that she's doing it, playing me without me knowing exactly how. She hasn't brought him here so she could watch me devour him like something out of an episode of My Uncle the Vampire. That would be pointless and unkind, which she's not, so her little tease isn't working on that level. But that doesn't explain what she is doing. Why did she bring this young man here? The way to spring the trap is to try backing out of it. She's overstating it a bit, I say to Zach. I just talk a good game. I start heading out. Excuse me, I have some work to catch up on. What's your book going to be about? Asks Zach, trying to get a game going. I look at Jolene, who looks back with mock curiosity. No book, I say, just playing with some ideas. Jolene said you didn't really agree with... Really, I don't know much. You know, tradition teaches us... Conformity and stagnation? Huh? I thought you were going to say that tradition teaches conformity and stagnation. I mean Buddhist tradition. Buddhist tradition shows us... Forget tradition. Start fresh, and you'll have a much better time of it. Start your own tradition. Really, I have to run. He laughs a bit. You can't just dismiss centuries of, sure you can, I say. In fact, you have to, or else you'll end up right where everyone always ends up. What's the point of that? He laughs a bit uncomfortably, sizing me up to see what he's dealing with. Tradition is just a word for stuff you accept as true, without verifying it for yourself. Tradition is the deeply rutted path that gets formed after many years of being followed by the herd. Buddha said this. Shankara said that. Who gives a fat rat's ass what they said or what anyone said? You don't know they said it. You don't know what they meant by it. You don't know if it's been passed down accurately. You don't even know they existed. So what do you know? You don't know anything. And if you did, you still wouldn't. It's self-verify or fail. Simple as that. The uncritical acceptance typical of the herd mentality is the soil in which all false beliefs take root. Instead of self-reliance and self-determination, most people just buy a package deal. No thinking required. Jolene told me you like to take a subjective approach. Yes, I am reminded. Jolene is all that matters here. As opposed to what? I ask. As opposed to taking an objective look, he says. He seems to catch a wave of energy, and suddenly he's off. You have to get the whole picture. You have to understand just what a really great evolutionary plan we're a part of. This whole thing, this whole planet Earth and human race and all the rest of it. It's like this one great big spiraling self-evolving experiment in the mind of God. I plan on going to a Zen monastery as soon as I can get up the money to get to Kyoto. Get myself into the presence of a true master. Those people really understand this stuff. He's a full-body talker. His energy extends outward into his arms and legs so that his hands lend emphasis to every point, and his whole body moves up and down, to and fro. He has to set his bottle of tea down, or he'll jostle it all over the floor. I prudishly place a coaster under his bottle, and he doesn't miss a beat. I look at this whole thing, this whole world thing, as if it's real, but there's no reality to it, he exclaims animatedly. Perception creates reality. But whose perception? Mine? Yours? Jolene's? I shake my head in wide-eyed bewilderment. No, he continues, because we have no more reality than anything else. That's the whole thing Zen teaches us, that there is no us. Ego, self, me, you. It's all an illusion, a facade. Zen destroys the facade. That's the purpose of Zazen, of sitting in meditation under the guidance of a great Roshi. That's what koans are for. You have to break through these barriers. It's all really so simple. They make it seem so complicated, so you have to keep coming to them to get it explained or something, you know, the religious people and the gurus and everyone. But it's really so simple. I can see now what my role is to be. I would never consider conducting any sort of dialogue with Zach, since he's very much in the outward expression mode and nowhere close to the shut-up-and-listen mode. He has no questions, only answers. Anyway, Jolene wouldn't have brought him here just to see me debate him on his level. I start to suspect that the reason she did bring him here is quite nearly the same reason for her coming here in the first place. We're all just pieces, continues Zach without pause, small units playing our role in this vast spatio-temporal matrix, like a universal continuum, you know? We're all so small, and yet each of us is like the whole thing. It looks like there's all this stuff going on, but there is no stuff. No you, no me. That's the whole point of Zen Buddhism, and that's why it's so cool. You don't learn it, you do it. You don't study and work hard to master concepts. You sit and work on koans under a qualified Roshi until the whole illusion thing just pops out of existence. See? Ultimately, there is only consciousness. Everything else is just perception. Cool, I say, smiling and nodding to keep him going. Out of the corner of my eye, I see what I hope to see. Jolene has a polite, attentive smile pasted on her face, But in her eyes, I can see that this little get-together is playing out as well as could be hoped. She is seriously unamused. Maybe Zach sounded better to her in the coffee shop. Probably she's never seen anyone like Zach, or been exposed to this sort of big, fun, spiritual odyssey approach before. There's only one truth, dude, see? And it doesn't matter what you call your spiritual path, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism or Catholic or Zen, because it's really all the same thing. This right here, he indicates us, the loft, Earth, the third dimension. This ain't it, man. This ain't the real thing. The real thing is, like, beyond all our dreams. I see how he functions. I see that he's so consumed by playing his big, expressive role that it will be virtually impossible for him to hear anything except his next cue. I test this theory with an out-of-nowhere question so Jolene can see it too. But what about war? I ask. War! Exactly! That's what I'm saying. If everyone would just, you know, like burst out of their self-centered me, me, me mindset and try to adopt the universal view, which, like I'm saying, is the real thing, the way things really are, then they'd forget all about war. Can you imagine what a paradise this world could be if everyone just became, like, aware of their true potential? Can you imagine? He looks to both Jolene and me to see if we can imagine, and is too swept up in his own momentum to notice that we're not exactly in the same space he's in. War would be completely forgotten. It would be like something in the history books. And instead of man focusing all his attention and resources on, you know, the Pentagon and controlling other people and stuff, we could focus on the things that really matter, like feeding people and curing disease and flood relief and stuff. Can you imagine if everyone just stopped all this coveting and hatred and fear and really started pulling together and trying to make a difference? Think of what a wonderful paradise this whole world could be if there were no more polluters and oil spills and crime and stuff. This would be a paradise. It would be like heaven, except not later on in some weird, you know, after you die and clouds and everything, but right here on Earth. That's what God really wants for us, but we've totally screwed it up. He pauses to take a breath and to see if we're managing to keep up. It's obvious that he's reading from several different scripts, a not uncommon approach. Melting pot spirituality, New Age eclectic. He's like a bag lady, combing the alleyways of esoteric philosophy and tossing every pretty bauble and gewgaw he finds into his magical mystery cart, eager to share his mismatched collection with anyone who can't distinguish priceless from worthless. I suppose that if he ever gets to a Kyoto monastery, the first thing they'll do is hoist him up by the ankles and shake all this loose crap out of him, like weapons off a cartoon gangster. I'm toning his speech down a bit in order to give the reader some idea of what he was saying without using all the exclamation points a more accurate rendering would require. I'm also taking the liberty of removing many hundreds of you-knows, likes, stuffs, mans, and dudes. I never really had much exposure to coffeehouse spirituality, if that's what this could be called, but I'm actually enjoying it. Zach has a lot of personal charm, and the fact that he's so stoked up by what he's talking about makes him fun to listen to. For me, anyway. I don't think Jolene is having so much fun. I look and see what Zach has failed to notice. Jolene is staring straight through him. I also see that this couldn't have been planned better. Zach's scattergun message and unique style of spiritual carpet bombing is exactly what she needs to be seeing right now. "So what can we do about it?" I ask, not wanting to let Zach pause too long and lose his momentum. He eyes me for an instant to see if I'm sincere, and either decides I am, or that it doesn't matter, before launching back into his discourse. I want to keep him going a bit longer, because I want Jolene to get this and be done with it. Whatever is operating in her, I don't want it left squirming because I was soft and wanted to be gentle with her. It's much more humane to get these things killed while the killing is good. "Exactly," Zach resumes with infectious good cheer. "What can we do? That's the whole issue. The whole question of, you know, spirituality, of religion, comes down to that one thing. What can we actually do? We have to grow, expand. We have to shake off this." Here he twists his mouth and squints his eyes and curls his fingers into claws to convey his disgust at what most people call life. This smallness, he says. He looks to see if I get it. I have the next question in my eyes. "Yes," my gaze asks, "but how? How do we do it?" He states it aloud. "That's the big question. How do we get out of our small, irrelevant little selves and start enjoying, you know, reaping the benefits of our true potential? It's all about self-realization. That's all it is, really. It all sounds so massive and, you know, like science fiction, but it's not. That's the thing. This isn't all pie in the sky and everything. This is the truth of each one of us. This is who we really are." "And?" say my eyes. "And," he rocks on, "that's what we have to do. We have to break out of these tiny little shells, and then we can step up into our true universal selves. That's where it's at. All this here, everything we think of as everything, is really like nothing. That's what Zen is all about, returning to our true state, the state of non-being. Once we do that, realize our true state, we're liberated. No more coming back. No more cycle of births and deaths. No more karma. No more suffering. We're finally free." Zach goes on for another few minutes, but starts losing energy and fumbling a bit when it comes to the actual methods by which such liberation might be attained. He has some favorable views on meditation, prana, kundalini, getting outside more, eating better, reading elevating books, drinking green tea, and spending less time in malls. He looks around at our fairly upscale digs and gives me a look that suggests I might take an honest look at my own overly acquisitive tendencies. I guess Jolene didn't tell him it was a rental. The point of sharing all this isn't to poke fun at Zach or anyone at Zach's particular level of comprehension. I think I was probably like Zach myself at some point, thrilled and awed, eager to express and share, a little sketchy as far as doctrine went, a big-eyed boy in a vast toy store of shiny new ideas. Jolene is probably right. A few more years and someone with Zach's enthusiasm and powerful presence will probably be playing the satsang circuit. He can't keep pounding out his crazy jazz chops, though. It's not enough to be a great player. You've got to have something to play. People want a catchy melody laid over a soothing, familiar harmony. If he's smart, he'll hitch his wagon to Advaita. That's the hot new sound. He's tending towards Zen, but that tune has been played to death. The industry needs a new Zen, and Advaita fits the bill. It sounds exotic. It means something vaguely profound yet unthreatening, and no one cares about its roots, so it comes with no baggage and can be molded to meet the demands of the marketplace. No, it's not a merchandiser's dream like Zen, but they'll fix that, and soon we'll all be buying Advaita cookware and Advaita thongs and Advaita ceiling tiles in no time. A sugary sort of Advaita junk philosophy has already begun to emerge, and I'm sure it will have its own key figures. Perhaps Zach someday, writing books and instructing us in the way of non-duality. Shit. As I think about it, I'm talking myself into writing another book, something with huge commercial appeal, like Zen and the Tao of Advaita. The pathless path of no mind to not-to-ness. Or maybe Zach will go to Kyoto and hang around the Ballbusters for a while. That's a sad thought. Westerners seem to get a strong Zen buzz built up, and the next thing you know, they're returning from a Zen monastery 5 years later, with less to show for those years than if they'd been spent in prison or a coma. Admirably, they seldom allow failure to discourage them from writing a book on the subject. Most likely, young Zach will just get himself situated at his own spiritual comfort level and go on to live a normal life. Anyway, Zach isn't my concern. Jolene is. I manage to usher Zach out as Jolene makes a vague promise to meet him at the coffee shop before she leaves the city. When I return to the living area, Jolene has gone to her own room and closed the door. Bookstore Guru. On the last full day of Jolene's visit, one of the big downtown bookstores is hosting a lunch hour reading and a book signing by a best-selling New Age author. She wanted to go hear him speak. She asked me to go with her, which I did, but I didn't want to listen to this person speak. So when I got to the store, I sent her in alone and we made arrangements to meet up after. I arrive at our appointed meeting place early, but she's earlier. She looks pretty dejected, and I'm starting to have a pretty good idea why. She came here looking for something, and she's not finding it. The guy who spoke at the bookstore sells a lot of books, and she understood that to mean that he had something valid to say. She assumed, as many do, that the more popular a teacher is, the more valuable the teaching. "You're too young and pretty to look so sad," I tell her. "I'm fine," she replies. "Can we go somewhere else? Walk or sit?" "Walk, I guess." We walk, and I don't talk. I'm glad she seems sad and angry. I would have been surprised and a bit disappointed if she'd come away from that event in high spirits. I knew she wouldn't, though, but that was no reason to discourage her from going. Just the opposite. If she had a yearning to take a closer look at this particular fellow and his views, but didn't follow through because she sensed I wouldn't approve, that would have just been repression, and she'd have to deal with the source of the yearning again later in a more pernicious form. The process of awakening is a series of disillusionments, and each one hurts. We head down into the subway and catch the C train. We emerge at 81st Street and head into Central Park. We amble about, and she shows signs of recognizing where we are and starts bubbling up out of her gloom. She knows part of the park from different movies she's seen. She's still not talkative, and I'm not wishing she was. So we head over to Fifth, near the museums, and hail a cab back to the loft. Instead of going up, though, we stroll down the street to a coffee place, grab some fancy drinks, and settle in on an overstuffed couch. She tucks her legs under so she's able to face me more directly. I want to talk about nothing for a few minutes. I know what kind of mindset she's in, and I want to help her relax a little and not be jumping out of her skin. I launch into a very endearing little diatribe about how the marketing bastards at the Ministry of Newspeak have so effectively removed the words small, medium, and large from our vocabulary that coffee vendors and fast food clerks can't even translate them anymore. If you want a medium coffee or a small order of fries, I explain to Jolene, who isn't half listening, you have to learn that particular establishment's particular jargon. In one place, small, medium, and large might now be grande, supremo, and el presidente. In the next place, they're large, parentheses small, extra large, parentheses medium, and aversion therapy, parentheses large. Most annoying is the blank look you receive from the clerk when you try to revert to simpler but unsanctioned terminology. So, extra large is medium? You ask. No, like, extra large is extra large, you're told. I look up when she doesn't respond and find a startling sight. She is staring at me, wide-eyed, tears streaming down her face. She is completely open and unabashed, making no effort to conceal herself. She allows herself to be profoundly exposed. I show respect for her unguardedness by gazing back at her with equal frankness. Her breathing is a barely audible moan. This is a very sad young lady. I feel so small, she says in a hoarse whisper. I feel so alone. I've never felt like this. I don't see an end. I don't see how it can get better. I don't reply right away. My natural tendency, like anyone's, I suppose, would be to console her. But she's in the early stages of grieving for her own lost life, feeling the separation from herself and processing that unexpected and unprecedented loss. She doesn't need to be consoled at this point. She needs to go through this and come out the other side. The thing she's grieving for isn't fully dead, and the thing that's grieving isn't fully born. So what she's going through right now is more like the coming attractions reel. Try to step out of yourself and observe this moment, I tell her. I know that sounds difficult, that you're completely immersed right now, but it's important. You have to learn to separate yourself from your character. And the best time to do that is when it's hardest to do. Anyone can enter the witnessing mode when it's all blue skies. The trick is doing it when black clouds are rolling in. Look at this pain you're feeling. Look at the person experiencing the pain through my eyes instead of yours. Take a breath and do it now. She takes a breath and releases a long, shuddering sigh. She closes her eyes, and I turn my attention away. When I look back, little Jolene is eyeing me with the half smirk of someone who brought a gun to a knife fight. That's a good look to have. "Can I tell you why I came here?" she asks. "Why I wanted to see you?" "Can I tell you?" I reply. She remains motionless for a second, then nods. "You want someplace to go. You want to find a group of people to be with. You want to land somewhere, to be part of something. You hope that there is such a thing. She's biting her bottom lip now and nodding her head. Something around Buddhism, I guess. Something in California? She nods silently. Zen? Another nod. You made a wrong turn, I say. California's the other way. She doesn't move. Or maybe you already knew the answer, and you didn't want to believe it. So now I'll say it for you. You're already beyond Buddhism. Buddhism, even Zen, would be a step backward for you. And there are no backward steps. We can never go back. It's not an option. You understand that? She nods. You're on your own, kid. You're already further out than Buddhism goes. You're further out than anyone can go with you. You know there's no more being a part of things for you, and you came to see me in a bit of a panic, looking for a different answer. You want to hook up, maybe to Buddhism, maybe to some best-selling author or cool groove satsang teacher, maybe to me. Maybe you thought I could catch you, reel you in, make it all solid for you again. You think? She sits, motionless, head down. You had firm footing, and you started losing it that day when you saw the cows in church. Now, you're scrambling to find it again, but you never will. You're floating up out of the warm muck in which most people spend their lives. That muck is the only life you've ever known, and now you're leaving it behind. Very scary. Don't waste time feeling bad about it. Everyone panics at this point. You can't not. No one slips gracefully beneath the waves. This is way past bravery and cowardice. Those terms mean nothing here. Is this the first step? She asks. Yes, this is the first step, which is really the last step. See that? Between damnedest and spiritual autolysis, you didn't need me. You already had everything you needed. You could have saved yourself the airfare. She doesn't laugh or smile. In her eyes, I see that she is already older than most people ever get. City Lights. We arrive back at the loft, worn out and hungry. I grab a bite and lay down for a nap, telling Jolene to fend for herself. She's leaving early in the morning, and I think she's a little disappointed to discover that we're not doing a nice restaurant or theater or anything special on her last night. I wake up from my nap at around 7:30 and find her dozing on the futon. I nudge her with a foot and she opens her eyes. "Hi," she says. "Hi," I say back. "Get ready. We're going out." She rolls up onto her knees. "Should I dress up?" she asks eagerly. I look at her like she's nuts. "No, anything is fine." "Oh," she says, disappointed. "Okay." We head out and up a few streets where it's easier to find a cab. I give the driver a street address. He says, "You mean the..." and I say, "Make it the Seaport," before he blurts it out. A few minutes later, we emerge from the financial district to the East River piers. We get out of the cab near the Seaport and head south on foot, the Twin Towers looming large above. She sees a sign for the Staten Island Ferry. "Are we going to ride the ferry?" she asks. "Doesn't that sound like fun?" She tries to sound enthusiastic. "Yeah." I laugh and we continue walking. I stop in front of the heliport. "What's this?" she asks. "What's it look like?" I ask. "A helicopter place," she says. "That's what it is, a helicopter place." "Yeah? So? What are we doing here?" she says. I borrow a line from contact. "Want to take a ride?" Her eyes get huge. "No way!" She wallops me a good one. "Way." "No way!" she says, and I jump back before the next walloping. Way? "Wow! Really? Where are we going?" It's called a City Lights Tour. We're just going to fly around Manhattan, probably from here to the Statue of Liberty, up the Hudson, hook around the Bronx and down the East River. See the city, the bridges, or, you know, Jersey and Brooklyn if you get a shitty seat. She darkens a few degrees. "A shitty seat? How many people?" I laugh. "Just you and me, kid. Now, this is a pretty romantic thing, so I don't want you getting all gushy on me." She pushes me and then gets very solemn. "I can't do this," she says quietly. "It's too much. This must cost like $1,000. "Not quite. Anyway, you're doing me the favor. I've wanted to do this for years, but not alone. You're doing this for me as much as I'm doing it for you. Okay?" "Really?" she says, almost pleading. "Really." For a few $100, you can jump out of an airplane 2 miles high and probably live. For under $100, your local flight instructor will take you up in a Cessna and let you drive. For less than $1,000, you can take a night flight over one of the world's great cities at its most radiant and splendid in a privately chartered helicopter. Bungee jumping, super coasters, whitewater rafting. At 10 times the price, these experiences would be among the greatest bargains one can strike in life, the most memorable and cherished. These are the things that will be with us on the deathbed, not the money we didn't spend. The cost of this night flight isn't going to put a dent in my lifestyle, but even if it was my last nickel, to what better use could I possibly put it? We go in. I leave her in the seating area while I handle some things at the counter and hit the head. I return and we go back outside to talk. We have time before moonrise, so we go for a stroll. Time to give Jolene what she came for. Within the context of your personal life, of your future, Jolene, what can you say for sure? She knows this is something she's supposed to think about, and she does. She takes a full minute before she answers. "Well, I'm going to die, I guess."
"You guess?"
"No, I mean, I don't guess. It just sounds weird to say it."
"Say what?"
"I'm going to die." There's a line in the Mahabharata, Krishna talking to Karna, the warrior who will fight Arjuna. Krishna is telling Karna, in essence, that Arjuna's victory is assured.
"Yeah, I watched it."
Krishna tells him, "Look, it's spring. The buds are sweet. The water sparkles. Everyone is joyful. We are going to die." She looks at me for a long moment, wondering where this is going. In this or any similar conversation, there are two different dynamics at work. There's the apparent dynamic, which is what Jolene sees and what any onlooker would see. And there's the underlying dynamic, which is what I see and where the real work is getting done. It's as true of me and Jolene standing on a New York sidewalk as it is of any conversation I have or words I write. The person who appears to be the intended recipient is, in a way,
just an agent, a go-between, and sometimes an unwitting one. It looks like I'm talking to Jolene, but I'm really talking through her. I'm speaking past the shell to the little bastard within. I always think of it as a masculine energy, regardless of the host's gender. The little bastard is hidden in there, deep behind the eyes. He's jumping up and down, waving his arms, trying to get my attention. He doesn't know exactly what he wants from me, but he thinks I know, and he's right. He wants what any revolutionary plotting a violent overthrow wants: weapons and intelligence, things that burn and destroy, and the knowledge to aim them and use them. The real thing that's going on here is that rebel forces have contacted me for aid, and I am surreptitiously providing it. I'm happy to oblige them because that's what I do: support rebellion. I don't incite it. I don't have to. It incites itself. Then, if it happens to seek me out, in book or in person, I'm able to provide what it needs. I have to sugarcoat it a bit so Jolene can swallow it. But once it's in her system, the little bastard can digest it at his leisure. It's the same in conversation as it is in the books I write. The information in the books could be provided in a much drier form, in much less space, and be much less palatable. I doubt I've ever expressed an original thought, or one that hasn't been expressed many ways, many times before. The secret's in the sauce. The battle that is brewing within her won't be between the little bastard and Jolene, as it may appear, but between the little bastard and Maya. Maya, on this battlefield, will be represented by fear, and the little bastard by hate. Fear versus hate. Fear of no self versus hatred of false self. These are the armies facing each other on the fields of Kurukshetra. These are the forces between which Arjuna collapses. This is the one true war of which all others are but shadows, and for which all other conflict is but a metaphor. In the short term, Maya almost always crushes the rebellion. By my estimate, her win-loss ratio is better than 100 million to 1. By using her vast array of tricks and treats to buy, charm, misdirect, or distract potential rebels, she keeps them too happy, sad, engrossed, or content to move, easily and effectively precluding an uprising before it gets much past the stage of mild discontent. In the long term, however, the overthrow of Maya is certain. Truth is, and delusion isn't. Ultimately, duality is an artificial construct, and when it's gone, truth is what remains. Viewed this way, the idea that Maya is evil, that delusion is negative, that the dream state is a prison, or that the dualistic universe is anything other than the grandest and most wonderful of all blessings, is laughably absurd. Why hate Maya? Where would you be without her? Jolene herself is only vaguely aware that this battle brews within her. In a way, she's just an innocent bystander caught between two massing armies. Of course, the rebels are just a small band of peasants with pitchforks at this stage, but they're getting their act together. They've convinced Jolene to make this trip to see me, and they've managed to get the attention of a well-placed sympathizer. Not bad. Of course, you can just say that the little bastard is a part of Jolene. That's true. But you can also say that the little bastard will be the death of Jolene.
That's true, too. Death and discrimination. You and I, Jolene, are about to get on a helicopter, a flying death trap. I should tell you, the pilot is drunk and grossly overweight. His wife just left him and took the kids. I saw him blubbering in the bathroom, taking pills. She giggles. We could be dead a few minutes from now. You remember I mentioned in the book some advice I gave a guy from the Billy Jack movie? The Trial of Billy Jack, she corrects me. I saw that, too. If you knew we were going to die tomorrow, how much would this really matter? That was the question. That's absolution. Pre-absolution. That's what death is. Guaranteed absolution. Freedom and forgiveness, all in one. If you understand the fact of your own death, that it's always here with you, and that it's a certainty, then you're free. That's liberation. Knowing that nothing is yours or can be yours. Knowing that you have nothing to lose. Other people push death away, deny it. But we don't have that luxury. We have to pull death close, embrace it, carry it in our hearts and minds. I don't mean like a college kid getting stoned and having a one-night stand with existentialism. I mean like something you carry in your pocket and always have one hand on. There are two kinds of people in the world, make-believe people and serious people. You're a serious person, Jolene. That's what you're becoming. You're in the game now, and you have to play by the rules. You always say that. A serious person. What does that mean? Focus. It's all about focus. You have to learn to be an utter failure in 99% of your life. You can accept that because you're not a failure in the one part that matters. You have to jettison all sub-identities. Be a bad person. A bad citizen. Stop shaping yourself to the world. Shape yourself to your task and let the world despise you or, preferably, forget about you. You want to be a good citizen? Vote? Study issues? She ponders and nods. Fuck it. Be a crappy citizen. Better, don't be a citizen at all. Simply abandon that identity. Chop it off. You want to be a good daughter, friend, sister, wife someday, mother? Forget it. Let it all go. Simply cut away all these anchors. All opinions you have of yourself are like the timbers of a false structure. All must go. All will go. The process has begun. The less you resist, the easier it will be. She seems overwhelmed by this, as well she should. It's seldom advisable to look more than one step ahead. Even the step after the next will always appear ridiculously impossible. But right now, Jolene is staring at the first step, and the fact that she hasn't been rendered catatonic by the view is a testament to her honesty and resolve. As I've pointed out before, this is where people can break. This is where it's all going anyway. You have this whole life, your home and your schools and community and all that, everything you've done, everything you are, the future that was laid out before you. But all that has to be released for you to go on. And it will be. All your choices have already been made. You don't choose whether to let it all go, only whether or not to struggle against the process. And the thing that makes an easier transition possible is death. These false layers are like your skin. It can be torn away slowly
with excruciating pain, or you can just slough it off like a snake, layer after layer, just letting it all fall away. The way to do that, to allow the process rather than battle it, is to embrace your own death. Keep one hand on your death and fight your battles with the other. I don't have any choice in all this. I don't have any freedom. Freedom? I don't know what that means. It's just a concept word. Freedom isn't a thing itself. It's an incomplete idea. You have to be free from something. What do you want to be free from? How about this whole thing, this whole process? What if I don't want to do it? What if I just want to make the whole thing stop and go back to having a normal life? I pause to give her time to breathe. Okay. Okay? What does okay mean? It means okay. Store this conversation for later. I'm not your teacher, you know. I'm someone just like you. Except I've already finished something you're just starting. If you want to learn about trying to turn back, try to turn back. She releases a mighty sigh. I don't know what I want. You want to attach, I tell her. That's the urge that brought you here. You want to join up with people, a group, be a part of something, something big and safe and respectable. You sense yourself spinning off into oblivion, and you're clawing desperately to grab a hold of something. This is a very powerful urge, and pretty much everyone succumbs to it. That's the big trap, the one that pulls us in and spares us from the paradigm shift, the point of no return, the first step. Does all this sound right to you? I guess. I wait. Yes. This was touched upon in Damnedest. We're all treading water in a shoreless sea, and we huddle together into groups to convince ourselves that our situation is other than it is. That's make-believe. Serious people want to confront the real situation. To do that, they have to leave the group and stop treading water. Surrender to the inevitable rather than live a life of pointless struggle. They have to go off by themselves and allow themselves to sink. This is the point no one goes beyond. This is what everyone lives in denial of, what they must, at all costs, stay turned away from. The emperor has no clothes. Obviously. Anyone who opens their eyes and looks will see. But for this whole dream state deal to work, people have to see clothes. It doesn't matter what the clothes look like, but they can't see naked. This is what Maya must work against, the plain truth. What does she have to do to keep people from seeing the obvious? Baffle them with bullshit. Judeo-Christian bullshit, Hindu bullshit, Buddhist bullshit, New Age bullshit. They're all just varieties of agnosticism, and they all result in exactly the same thing. Spiritual embafflement. It's that simple. The emperor has no clothes. It's all just make-believe. When we want to stop playing make-believe, we become serious people. Of course, everyone sinks alone anyway, but the serious person can't stand the lie of pretending the sea isn't shoreless, or that the darkness isn't absolute, or that death isn't always a breath away. The urge to attach is the survival urge, the urge not to drown, not to sink into the blackness. I stop walking and look at her. It's natural to panic, I say, and that's what you're doing now. That's what all this trying to hook up is about. You're in a life or death struggle to survive, and my job is to help you die.
Is that what you've been doing? Helping me die?
Indirectly. I've been trying to help you grab onto something so that you can see for yourself that it can't be done. The process works. It doesn't need me or anyone else. Now you're starting to see that it's no longer possible to attach. You are chasing mirages in a desert. Everything you try to grab at disappears. You can't grab anything because there's nothing to grab. Maybe you think you can grab onto me, but that won't work either. You want a friend? A companion? Let death be your companion. That's the one thing you really have, the one thing that's really yours that no one can take away. Her expression is taut, her eyes locked on mine. No teary eyes or trembling lips. No young girl pout or smirk. A warrior is emerging. There will soon be a power shift in Jolene. Rebel forces will overthrow the old regime. A new constitution will be imposed, and the excesses and frivolities of the make-believe regime will be swept away. A new government will assume control and impose martial law and a wartime constitution that has no place for anything but the machinery of destruction. Identity will wither. Preferences will fade. Relationships will be abandoned. Love itself will be forgotten. That's the first step. And for Jolene, it's coming soon. You're going to tough places. You're in for a whole different type of life than you see people living around you. You're getting a glimpse now of what loneliness looks like. No, not loneliness. Aloneness. And there's plenty more ahead. But this too shall pass. She looks down and nods. This too shall pass, she repeats. The pain of the transition will pass, not the aloneness. The aloneness actually becomes very comfortable. I lift her chin. You have to go beyond the place where death is a morbid and evil thing. It's about liberation, not at the end of life, but during, when it matters. Now, look up. Look at me. I am happy to die at any time. Makes no difference to me. Now, later, whatever. I love the fact of my death. It's what has made my life possible. It's how I've known what my life was and what to do with it. If I knew that helicopter was going to crash tonight, I'd step aboard with a joyous and grateful heart. We walk for a while in silence. This is heavy stuff to be sharing with a teenager who has her whole life ahead of her and shouldn't have to even consider her own mortality for many decades. But Jolene isn't normal. She's getting in on the game, and the game has rules. Your life will be a war, I tell her in a soft tone. It already is. People hate war because they fear death. But death is your best and most certain friend. Not me, not the Tibetans, or the Japanese, or some pop guru, or coffee house mystic in training. This is what you came here to learn. It seems strange to lecture a beautiful young girl about death, but you're not just a beautiful young girl, are you? You're something else. That's what you're finding out now, isn't it? I don't think I can really do it. You are doing it. This is it, one step at a time. I'm scared, she says. Of what? She thinks about it. I don't know. Good. Find out. That's how you know where to go. Follow the fear. Go into it and light it up. Inside your fear is the next door and the next thing holding you in. Let fear be your guide. She wraps herself around my arm as we continue to walk. We go in and sign some stuff as they crank up the comfortable executive chopper outside on the pad. Jolene sees that the pilot is quite trim, handsome, and appears emotionally stable. She's thrilled by everything, which makes it thrilling for me. When we're standing outside waiting to be waved aboard, Jolene is hanging comfortably on my arm. She tiptoes up and speaks in my ear. "It's such a pretty night," she says. "I hope we don't crash." I laugh and smile down at her. "No way you're getting off that easy."